You are listening to The News Project for the week of October 27th, 2019, brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's podcast brings you these stories. With Londonderry now infected with the Emerald Ash Borer, we thought it was a good time to rerun a news segment with Forester Alan Calvey. Workforce issues front and center in Bennington. And we ask Alan Benoit, what is permaculture?
There's actually another clue specific to Ohio that gave this away. If you look around carefully, there's these small holes all around it, and there's actually signs of bark peeling off. And in Ohio and other areas around here, we've had problems with the emerald ash borer, which has pretty much wiped out most of the ashes.
Here we have an emerald ash borer. The good news is that it's dead. The bad news is it was first identified in Vermont this summer and in Washington County around July, and subsequently it has been identified in Bennington County in Pownal, right, and also in Grand Isle County up in North Hero.
Like, when I'm listening to crickets, could there be as many crickets as there are emerald ash borers one day?
Yes. In places where it's occurred for a while, like Wisconsin, where there's literally millions of acres being affected, I'm sure it's millions of insects.
Today I'm with Forester Alan Calvey, and he's going to match the facts with hysteria when it comes to this bug.
Here we have a white ash. The Latin name for the species is Fraxinus. And
they get pretty big.
There are a number. This is a white ash, but we also have green ash and brown ash and black ash in Vermont, and they're all susceptible to emerald ash borer.
Are there any ash in Vermont that are not susceptible to this damn thing?
No. The emerald ash borer is... It only ash. Uses ash species, but it uses all the varieties of ash.
And how important a tree is this to Vermont?
Well, especially to us down here in southern Vermont, it's a very important tree. I mean, if you look around, there's actually probably 35% to 40% of this forest is white ash.
In southern Vermont?
In southern Vermont. Well, in this, where we're standing.
At least in this area. Okay.
For the state of Vermont, it represents about 5% of the total tree species for the 4.5 million acres of forest land. But remember, that includes the Northeast Kingdom and high elevation, right, and places where ash doesn't grow. So it sounds like a little number, but here it's in the huge. Taconics especially, it's an important species, and there's a lot of it in our forest.
Is this an important logging tree? Is this a money tree for loggers?
White ash is a pretty valuable species. Here we have a mill not far from us that makes tool handles. A worldwide known tool manufacturer that uses ash for tool handles, and they also make blanks for baseball bats.
Got it. So can you just give us a sense of time? When do I see it attacking my trees?
It's a very good question. Remember that the insect first showed up in Michigan in 2002, probably as a byproduct of shipping pallets or something like that off of boats from China, and it's slowly now spread to about 34 states, and only just been identified in Vermont in July in one location. But since that, now it's October, now they've found four other locations in Vermont where it's identified. Its speed of spread is strictly governed by human transportation. So the insect itself travels very slowly, they found, and does not disperse quickly. It's not capable of flying very far.
I see.
But it's either on firewood or on other products that are being moved around. That's how it's spreading. So someone could bring a load of firewood from Washington County down to their house in Manchester with emerald ash borer on it, in the period really between May and June when the adults are out flying, and we'll have it in Manchester.
We don't know how fast it's going to take over the state.
No.
You and I could be dead by the time it finally does that?
We would hope. I mean, we live a long time and it takes a long time for it to spread.
But that's not like an outrageous question, that it could take many, many, many years for it finally to be like Iowa and it has now taken over the entire state.
Yes. Yeah. Decades.
Right. We hope.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's one reason why people that study forest health and that type of thing don't want people to react hysterically. The commissioner of Forests and Parks has a great quote, is don't be rash with your ash.
So who cares if we lose this tree? I mean, aren't there a whole bunch of trees we've already lost? I mean, have we lost any other trees?
That's a really good point, Haas, because we've lost the American chestnut, which used to be well represented in this forest, American elm, which you'll still find immature trees, but they never grow to adulthood. We're losing our butternut to a fungus. American beech is also under onslaught by an exotic, meaning a pest that was brought from somewhere else.
Let's pretend this beautiful tree is in my front yard, and it's been there. How long do these things live for?
They can, ash is a longer lived species, so they can live 100 years.
All right, so how do I know my beautiful ash tree is infected?
What happens is the adult beetles emerge in the springtime, and they fly on the tree, and they lay their eggs actually on the bark of the tree, and the eggs hatch later in the summer, and the beetles bore in just below the bark into what we call the cambium, and they create these S-shaped galleries where they feed in the cambium. And then the adults exit the tree, and the emergent hole is a D-shaped hole. So it's flat on one side and round on the other.
Okay.
Very small. We saw the size of the insect, so you can imagine that. So you can see those D-shaped emergent holes. But what's turned out to be really more useful in identifying the presence of the insect is when the woodpeckers find the tree with the beetles in it, they start to peck at the bark and fleck it off, and you can see what would happen. You start to get this, it's being known as a blonding pattern. This whole side of the tree would have this kind of look to it, blonding. And that's something you can see at a distance, whereas a quarter of an inch D-shaped hole is very hard to find. Probably at that stage, there's going to be some dieback in the very tips of the tree, too.
Got it.
Because basically, the insect cuts off the flow of nutrients and water to the crown of the tree. It kind of girdles the tree. You might also see white ash has a stress response when it's starting to have problems in its crown. It'll produce these sprouts at the base of the tree, which is called a witch's broom. A big clump of branches coming right off the stump of the tree. As the tree is dying, it's basically trying to put out more photosynthetic leaves so it can make up for what it's losing.
So by the time you see that, the tree's probably past saving.
Yeah, yeah. If the tree is in your front yard, there are pesticides that are labeled for use for this particular insect, but you have to start using that before the insect shows up. So if the insect's in your tree, it's too late.
So here's the thing, we don't know how fast they're gonna reach Manchester.
Right.
So if you have one of these beautiful trees in the front of your building, you wanna start spraying now.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometime soon.
Yes, and it's probably an expensive proposition.
So
you're gonna really wanna love that tree.
Right.
And there are other things that can damage the tree besides this insect. So it's a bit of a gamble, which is why really it's not talked about much. It's not effective. And certainly in a forest, it's not an effective means of controlling the pest.
When I was reading up in Iowa, they said the state is 100% quarantined now. And that sounds to me like it means you can't really move stuff out. Is that true?
So Vermont, similarly, is under a quarantine statewide.
Okay.
For example, New Hampshire has chosen to do it county by county. And fundamentally what it means is you can't move ash material, particularly when the adults are flying, so May through July, outside of the quarantine area. with firewood.
Yeah, firewood's the big one, right?
Firewood, really shouldn't, they advise you not to move it more than 50 miles, but you're not allowed to move it outside of the state's boundaries. So even though there is Emerald Ash Borer in New York, you cannot move firewood to New York.
Okay, so are we sort of being hysterical? I mean, I know that Rutland's thinking about being proactive and wiping out ash on public property or something, and I know that Londonderry's talking about it, and Arlington's talking about it, and everyone doesn't know, and we heard that if you wait till it's died, then it's much more expensive to get rid of it as opposed to bringing in tree services now when it's alive.
Yes.
Should I kill everything? What's...
And I think, you know, for urban centers, cities and villages and stuff like that, they're learning from what's happened in other places that have been infested, where the trees die, the branches start to rot, the trees start to fall apart. Now all of a sudden you have this huge safety problem. And so in some ways being proactive like that is trying to get ahead of the curve a little bit. For the people who own forest land and who manage forest land, the state is really advising folks not to rush out and cut all your ash trees down for a couple right. different reasons. One is that it's not here yet. So if we went right. to this forest
right.
and started immediately cutting all the trees down,
kind of silly.
It's going to have a bit of a chain effect for some of those other organisms and things that
right.
depend on white ash. The other thing is that actually there has been some research that shows there is some genetic resistance in trees to the pests. So if we go out and we cut all our ash trees,
we don't know.
We may very well be removing that genetic material that has the solution.
Before I let you go, final thoughts. Now, talking here makes me realize that, thank God there's nothing killing the maples, but then I realize, no, that's kind of stupid, because there is something that's killing the maples. It's just not...
Here, yet.
Here, yet.
Yeah, Asian longhorn beetle.
Is it coming?
Well, it could, the same way with an emerald ash borer, it could be transported in the trunk of somebody's car with a load of firewood. If they came from, you know, right. Worcester, Mass, or somewhere where there's been a big outbreak to Vermont. It turns out that one spreads very slowly and it's fairly easy to identify and control. I say easy, I mean, Worcester, I think, cut 100,000 trees down, so it costs a few dollars.
So, it's final thoughts. What do you got?
So I guess Haas, to me, what I really hope that everybody understands is that our forests are really important. And in the whole discussion of climate change and carbon issues, the forest turns out to be really important because the trees capture carbon from the air and put them into their stems. So it's really helping us in that regard. It also turns out that the forests themselves have an effect on climate. So areas that have more forests, there tend to be a moderating effect with the climate there. And our forests here in Vermont are under a lot of different threats from changing climate, some of these bugs we've talked about, that really we need to be careful in how we take care of our forests, and maybe more than anything, try to keep as much land and forest, keep the forest as much as possible.
Local business people, educators, and service providers converged on the Bennington Museum on Thursday, October 24th, to discuss a wide range of workforce issues and their impacts on the state's economy. The Regional Workforce Summit was one of 12 being held around the state to provide a platform for sharing information and ideas, as well as to inform state policymakers about how Vermont's employers and educators can adapt to a changing environment. Attracting workers to move to Vermont can be a tough sell when the state's cost of living doesn't align well with the salaries that businesses can be comfortable about offering. And there are other factors to juggle: childcare costs, housing costs, transportation issues, adapting to global competition, at the same time as the state's workforce is aging and not growing. Jeffrey Lewis, who works as a facilitator and program planner with the state's 12 regional development corporations and the Department of Labor, said the workforce shortages were beginning to prompt serious discussions on long-term business strategies. And they aren't unique to Vermont, he added.
Well, this is a series of meetings we're doing across the state. We're doing 12 workshops like this. In the mornings, we talk with employers. In the afternoon, we talk with what we call providers, which is all the support systems and trainers that help prepare workforce to get them ready. So this morning, we were talking with employers. One of the things we just completed is to ask employers how the workforce shortage is affecting their business. We got a list of about 30 things that they talked about, ranging from learning to work with the millennial generation to not being able to find high-level talent and having, therefore, to develop remote work habits with people, build new technology, new work practices to deal with them. One of the things we are now learning is that the workforce shortage that we see is happening across the country and beginning to show globally. Japan has a terrible workforce shortage. China is beginning to have a workforce shortage. Even Bangladesh is beginning to show a workforce shortage as it becomes a more stable country. All that means is that those other countries that we thought were going to be a supply to the United States are no longer suppliers.
During the morning session, the roughly 30 local business leaders broke into smaller groups to discuss their concerns and possible solutions.
And, you know, when we advertise for kind of management supervisory level, that's normally what we'll see transfers from other states across. And we've done that over the past couple of years. And every one of them struggles to find housing that's affordable. I mean, they're coming from big cities like Denver, where the cost of living is higher than it is in Manchester, Vermont. However, one, finding the availability of, you know, an apartment is hugely difficult. Two is, when they are able to find something, it's about as expensive as it is in Denver. And so all of a sudden, and the pay scale is
lower. You make $100,000 somewhere else and live in D.C. or live in Boston. Until they decide to have a family, they're not coming back.
You know, the inheriting our career from our parents has always been a clear pathway from the family into the workforce. It's always worked really, really well. It worked really well in an agrarian society. It worked pretty well in an industrial society. It's not working well in a post-industrial society. So I challenge that the issue is that motivations have changed. I just think that the systems have changed and have not kept up.
The workforce summits are roughly at their midpoint. And when finished, Lewis and his colleagues will work on a report about their findings. Melissa Morrison, who runs At Home Senior Care, said the gathering was informative.
I think it was really exciting to see so many employers come together. I think there was lots of discussion that allows us to collaborate with each other. I think it creates a platform for us to work together as employers, ranging and with a scope of entry-level positions all the way up to professional level. I met some new people that I thought was great. I heard some great ideas on not only just focused on the weaknesses in our county, but looking at the opportunities of how we can improve. I think we had some great takeaways that I'm already looking to implement, and I look forward to collaborating with other employers in the area prior to the next workforce summit.
Dimitri Garter, the CEO of Global Z, a consumer data management firm based in Bennington, said the conversation at his table led to some new thinking on the workforce issue.
I think what we heard as part of the discussion in our group was more of an emphasis on systems thinking, that a lot of the decision-making processes are happening more in a siloed way, perhaps with a lack of understanding of how those decisions are impacting broader systems or other stakeholders in the process. So our team came up with some ideas around implementing some pilot projects to show how systems thinking can have a positive influence on the entire community.
There's no shortage of challenges on the workforce front. Practical solutions that can be quickly implemented may be something else. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Hey folks, Sas from GNET News. Recently I stopped in to visit Alan Benoit and asked him to give us his Reader's Digest version of just what is permaculture. GNET also filmed his lecture on the subject that was recently held at the Manchester Library, and we'll be running that this week as well.
So permaculture is an abbreviation, if you will, for permanent agriculture. So that means you're growing food constantly in the same environment over long periods of time. So you're not planting and harvesting and planting and harvesting every single year. So most of the things that we have here come back year after year after year, whether they're berries or fruits or nuts.
Alan, this is the area you're going to be talking about, and I'm looking at it, but I don't really understand what I'm seeing, so help me out here.
Sure. So you can see there's lots of different layers of plantings here. We have very low ground cover plants, then we have taller perennial herbaceous plants, and then we have shrub layer, and then we have understory trees, and then we actually have canopy trees. So part of permaculture is having all these different layers working together. They not only provide food, but also create habitat and can feed not just people, but also insects and birds and wildlife.
So there's so you can do in a very small amount of space a lot of good. Is that what you're kind of hinting at?
Yeah, absolutely. So here it's mid-October and we still have flowers blooming for the bees and the butterflies. We actually had a monarch butterfly on this colchicum yesterday. And the witch hazel is actually in full bloom, although it's hard to see these yellow flowers. But this is a shrub that's in full bloom in the middle of October. So we're still providing food for all the beneficial insects that we want to live in our yard permanently, so that they can take care of our crops permanently. So we're not just trying to create a beautiful flowering border here. We're actually trying to create habitats and different layers so that it's more welcoming to a variety of plant life, animals being birds and insects and all that. So Haas, here's another example of a layer, the vertical layer. So this is a climbing hydrangea vine on this side and Boston ivy on that side. So it's a layer that's also used in permaculture besides all the other ones we already talked about.
Right.
And then this may look like a perennial garden, a typical perennial garden in the middle of October when frost has hit it. But we still have thyme, which we can use in our garden here. And we have some oregano over in this patch here. And the last of our rhubarb here.
Got it.
So even though it's full of perennials, we're still growing food here well into October, possibly into November.
And these don't look like normal trees. What are these trees?
So just outside of the fence here, we have fruit and nut trees. We have chestnut trees down that end. My favorite are the peach trees, which we have in the middle here. And then there's about 15 hazelnut trees. We love harvesting the hazelnuts. And further from there, we have the orchard, so we have other fruit trees, apples and pears as well.
So before I ask you my last question, let me ask you this. So I managed to buy some fruit trees, and I managed to let the deer have a wonderful meal. So you seem to be doing very successfully with these.
Yeah, so once the fruit trees get big enough, they can pretty much fend for themselves, but it's getting them beyond that tasty young phase. So we usually wrap them in a wire mesh.
I got it. So I just left them to their own,
yeah.
Like a poor orphan child.
Yes, the deer will prune them for you.
Yes, they did a fine job. If I was going to start my own permaculture garden, am I saying that right, Alan?
Yes, you are.
How would I begin?
So the first things I would recommend are the things that you enjoy eating. For me, it's raspberries. So we planted some raspberry bushes and they fruit twice a year. Every year we get about 2 cups every single day during the summer that
wow,
we harvest.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And then peaches in Vermont, you know, it sounds like an oxymoron or something that can't happen. I'm hoping someday we have a peach festival in Vermont, but we've been growing peaches here for 20 years and we just love eating peaches, especially when you can them and you can open up a jar in February and have peaches in a snowstorm.
So,
and the hazelnuts, we're really surprised at how prolific they produce. So we really like our hazelnut bushes.
Is there anything in a permaculture garden that you keep mobile?
Keep mobile?
In other words, that you, it's winter's hit and you bring it inside. And then you just bring it back outside. Does that concept exist with this type of garden?
No, but we do grow greens right through the winter. So we make a cold frame in our vegetable garden and we grow salad greens through the winter.
Yep. And if I wanted to learn how to do this, besides sending lots of people to your house in the dead of the night, websites, books?
Yeah. You know, our local bookstore has plenty of choices for permaculture gardening books. And there nowadays, there's lots of websites, so definitely plenty of resources out there. But it's simple. You just plant something that you're going to eat year after year.
And if I wanted to bring in birds big time,
yeah,
what am I after?
It's interesting. If you practice permaculture, the birds will come. They love, you know, fruits and nuts and seed heads. So
it's all there.
Yeah, it's already there. And they really enjoy the different layers of you know, herbaceous layers as well as tree and shrub layers.
And they don't eat peaches.
Yes, blue jays tend to eat
our
peaches.
Okay.
But they usually only get a little bit.
Okay, so it almost sounds like you create a wonderful garden that everything, including yourself, is going to love to eat it. So you actually have to be ready to fight for your food.
Yeah, yeah. So we decide to pick the hazelnuts when the chipmunk starts picking hazelnuts for us. Then we know it's time we have to harvest before he gets them all.
So the birds and the chipmunks let you know when things are ripe.
Exactly.
Right. All right. Hey, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and showing us your terrific gardens.
Thanks, Os. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.